Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Bill Ivey. I'm the director of the Curb Center for Art, Enterprise, and Public Policy here at Vanderbilt. I want to welcome you to the first of our Curb lectures for 2007. It's great to see such a good turnout for what we are confident will be a very interesting and stimulating talk this afternoon. I want to acknowledge the presence in the back of the room of Congressman Jim Cooper. It's always great to have him here, wonderful member of Congress representing Nashville. And to introduce our speaker today, it's my pleasure to bring to the podium our associate director, Stephen Tepper, sociologist here at Vanderbilt, and a real expert in cultural and media policy. Stephen.
Welcome to this year's Curb Lecture. I want to thank Mike Curb and the Curb Family Foundation for their generous support of both this lecture and our center. Richard Lloyd, who's here at the front, is a sociology professor who told us that we needed to get Eric down here for this talk, so I appreciate the tip, Richard. The Curb Center's mission is to invest in research and conversations which will advance and improve the cultural life of this country. We believe that the content and the character of our cultural life, the institutions, the agencies that produce and disseminate and regulate culture should be subject to the same scrutiny and analysis as other domains of public life, transportation, housing, health, education. But to date, this has not been the case. We have left our cultural policies in the hands of the market and a few enlightened, or maybe not so enlightened, foundations. And we have, in this country, failed to stake out the public interest as it relates to culture and entertainment. This is why Eric Kleinenberg is such a perfect fit to give the Curb Lecture this year. His new book is about media consolidation. And perhaps an old New Yorker cartoon captured this best. In the cartoon, a news bulletin reads, "Big Media officially changed its name today to Humongous Media." Or as my 7-year-old daughter would say, "Ginormous Media." Now, big media is not a problem in it of itself. It's only a problem when it tramples on the public interest. But what is the public interest in art and culture and news and information? In the past, the public interest in media has been defined by regulatory agencies like the FCC in rather narrow terms. Media mergers have been evaluated based on their consequences for prices. Will a merger, for example, raise or lower the cost of cable TV? But the public interest must also include such issues as localism. Do radio stations, for example, have local DJs? Can a local artist even get on the radio these days? Are news events covered by local reporters? The public interest also concerns itself with the diversity of viewpoints, with creativity, with artistic development, with access to cultural heritage. And these are some of the issues that Eric will take up in his book, that he takes up in his book and will take up in his talk today. Eric is an associate professor of sociology at New York University. His first book, Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of a Disaster in Chicago, won 6 academic and literary awards. It was featured in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and NPR and PBS. Professor Kleinenberg is part of the movement to revive public sociology in this country, and he frequently writes for publications such as Rolling Stone, The Nation, Slate. He appears on public radio and cable news programs. And he is here to discuss his new book, The Battle to Control Media, which has just been put out by Metropolitan Books. I think this is the first week it's out, or last week. So we're delighted that Vanderbilt is one of the stops that Eric has decided to launch the book. And without further ado, Eric, please.
Can you hear me okay? I can't tell you what an honor it is to be here. It really is a thrill. First of all, if anyone has ever written a book, you'll know that it's just a thrill to see the thing out in the world and off of your computer. It's a book I spent about 5 years doing research on. And I hope that you can see the results of the research when you crack the spine, and if you crack the spine. So it's a relief, but it's genuinely an honor to be here. And I want to say that I think it's particularly appropriate that we hold the CURB lecture this year on Martin Luther King Day. At first I thought, this might be funny. Is this a strange day to have it? I happened to grow up in a school system where we went to school on Martin Luther King Day, and the day was full of programming to commemorate Dr. King. But there's a special reason, I think, which is that if you spend time listening to people talk about the issue of media today, you will hear a tremendous amount of concern about opening up the media as a civil rights and human rights issue. In fact, I've been at two conferences or conventions in the last few months where Reverend Jesse Jackson has spoken about media reform as specifically a civil rights issue. There are issues about representing one's own voice and having a right to the airwaves, a right to be well represented in the airwaves, and not only when there are black issues in the news. And I want to get into some detail today, the relationship between media consolidation and the loss of diversity of voices, and particularly diversity of ownership over the airwaves. I think this is a pressing issue. I also want to say that I think this is an especially appropriate place to give a talk like this. There's a reason I wanted to come to Nashville during the first week of Fighting for Air, because I don't have to tell you that Nashville is America's music city. And you know that your culture here, your economy here, to some extent the health of Nashville hinges on the health and the vitality of the media, and especially the broadcast media. And I'm sure that I don't have to tell you that today the broadcast industry is the subject of a tremendous political debate. It's a debate that's getting hotter and hotter. I guess if I could use our president's favorite word of the moment, the broadcast industry is about to have a surge in its political debate. Expect a lot more activity around this. And so although my book really tries to address the entire media landscape today, from newspapers to alt-weeklies and internet kinds of debates, I thought it would be appropriate today to focus my remarks on broadcasting, and especially on radio. So that's what we'll talk about. And then in the question and answer period, if you want to bring up other issues, I'd be happy to do this. So you might know that this year Congress and the FCC are about to draft policies that will really shape the future of America's media landscape. We're opening up new pathways and closing down others in this time of the digital revolution that will be consequential, I think, for generations to come. And you might also have heard that the world's largest communications companies have issued a fairly robust set of demands. How many of you heard of the issue of network neutrality and internet freedom? Are those terms that mean anything to you? Well, today, telephone companies and cable companies who provide access to the internet have asked for the right to determine which websites come to us quickly and which websites come to us more slowly. They want to be able to say what works best on your computer. They want to be able to sell fast sites to deep-pocketed clients and leave everyone else in the slow lane. This, for those of you who haven't heard the term, is the network neutrality concept, and it's a live one. AT&T and Bell South just merged, as many of you know, in a $78 billion deal. One of the terms of the agreement for the FCC allowing that merger to go through is that AT&T, which I understand now is your local provider, goodbye Bell South, has promised to wait 2 years before going after the end of network neutrality again. And so in this next 2 years, there's going to be an enormous debate about this. But it's not just internet that's at stake. Multimedia companies want the right to cross-own a number of different media outlets. So currently, we have in place a cross-ownership ban. It's a rule that's been in existence since 1975, and it prohibits any corporation from owning a newspaper and a broadcast television station in the same market unless they get special exemptions. Well, the industry is pushing very hard right now to get the right to own the major newspaper three television stations, up to 8 or possibly 10 or 12 radio stations, the cable system, and the leading local website in every American city. In 1975, the FCC instituted the cross-ownership ban based on the idea that the two most important sources of local news for Americans are the newspaper and the television station. That remains true today, and yet there's quite a push to get rid of this policy. It's not just newspapers that are at stake. Television networks have been pushing for the right to own local stations in even more markets than they can today. And what about radio, this medium that matters so much for those of us who care about music and talk programming? I would urge you not to be fooled by news that radio companies are selling off their stations, and so therefore the age of big radio corporations and consolidation is over. Just a couple of decades ago, in the early 1980s, it was illegal for any company to own more than 7 AM and 7 FM stations overall, nationwide. And now, today, radio companies are pushing for the right to own 10 or 12 stations in any individual market. So these are extraordinary requests, you need to understand. These are really robust demands. And one question I want to ask you tonight, and I hope that we can discuss it after my remarks are done, is what is it that you want from this domain of American social policy? Stephen said, in other policy arenas, we have quite lively discussions about what we want, about what the democratic wish is. We get in touch with our congressional officials. We talk about it. Our debates appear on the front pages of newspapers. They sometimes are aired in television and radio. We tend not to get that same kind of coverage on media policy issues, is because I think there's so much at stake for media companies themselves. These are not issues that they want to give much voice to. But what is it that you want? Now, if you're like most of the Americans who've contributed to the debate we've had about these issues over the last couple of years, I can bet that you are opposed to almost every single one of the demands from major media corporations that I just listed. In fact, in recent years, according to even FCC officials who've pushed for more deregulatory policies, Americans by a margin of 9 to 1, maybe 99 to 1, have said that they've had enough of big media companies getting bigger, and that they're concerned about the effects of a decade of deregulation on the quality, the vitality of their local media. So when Americans speak out on this issue, they express overwhelming opposition to more consolidation. And yet, what we know from recent history is that when Americans speak out on this issue, neither the FCC nor Congress has paid much attention. And this is something that concerns me a great deal. And I want to emphasize this point as a kind of introductory remark about the politics of media policy, which is, I think, that there's a real paradox when it comes to this issue. It's a commonplace to say that the media in a democratic society is a foundational institution, that we depend on the health of the media for the health of democracy. Without it, we can't be informed, we can't engage, we don't even know what the issues before us are. And yet, when we make media policy in this country, we have tended to make it in a profoundly anti-democratic manner, as if the voice of the public matters not a bit. In fact, we also make it in an opaque manner. The FCC has operated with an extraordinary lack of accountability, and it has operated behind closed doors so that we don't really understand the processes through which they work. And I think that's something that we need to talk about. Because by law, at least since the beginning of the 20th century, you know, the early media policy, the first broadcast media policy came in the wake of the Titanic disaster, when Fighting for Eric tells the story in extraordinary detail. There was such profound miscommunication with the wireless system after the Titanic began to sink that a number of ships that were close to the Titanic and could have come to the rescue far more quickly than the one ship that did weren't connected. They didn't have their radios tuned into the right frequencies, and they couldn't save people. And then what happened is that there was so much chatter online with all the amateur operators that there was a massive amount of misinformation that circulated everywhere, just lots of information really fast, much of it untrue. I don't know if this sounds familiar to any people who paid attention to the internet, but essentially since the Radio Broadcast Act of 1912, and particularly since 1934, the Communications Act that set up the FCC, the government has said that the FCC is charged with serving the people's interest. The idea we learned is that we're going to treat the spectrum, we're going to treat the airwaves as public property, just like national parks. And we will allow corporations to run most of the system. We'll license corporations to have monopoly licenses on particular frequencies. We will even use government resources to protect those monopoly licenses, make sure if anyone tries to broadcast over your frequency and you have the license for that frequency, we will punish that person, we'll punish that organization. In exchange, all you have to do is provide a certain set of public service requirements. You have to come through with public interest obligations and recognize that this is a corporation that has some special responsibility. It's not like any other corporation. Its existence is due to the generosity of the American people to give out the airwaves for free in this way. Moreover, we demanded that the FCC have a special kind of mission for serving cities and communities. And we said, if we're going to have a corporate media system and we're not going to rely on the public sector to manage most of the media, which many democracies have done over the course of the 20th century and continue to do in the 21st century, we're going to do whatever we can to make sure that local media markets are competitive, have a diversity of information available to consumers, and that also are locally engaged, have local content, that they actually serve people's local interests. And I'm concerned, and this is a big theme of my book, and this is something I hope we can talk about tonight, that in the past decade, the FCC has acted as if these obligations that it has to enforce these missions are no longer, in fact, central. And informally, it's almost as if the FCC has gone through a shift in its philosophy, and it's made helping the advance the interests of a very small number of corporations to be its primary agenda. And I would argue that this has all come at the price of us. It's come at citizens' expense. But here's a problem, and I want to make this very clear up front. How do we measure the cost of media consolidation? How do we really get our hands around how the transformation of the American media landscape over the last 10 years has affected us, has changed the media around us? Well, to answer that question, I decided I was going to set out on my own kind of field work and do some empirical work. I traveled around the United States, and I wanted to survey the media landscape, really get a feel for what has happened. And I did this using sociological research. I tried to get inside of many of the largest media companies in the country. I wanted to get inside of the country's largest radio corporation, Clear Channel Communications. You may have heard of it. You have, I think, six Clear Channel stations in Nashville. It could be, I think it's six. I wanted to get inside of the biggest television stations. There's a company called the Sinclair Broadcast Group. You might have heard of it in the run-up to the 2004 election. I think you have three Sinclair Broadcast Group stations in the area around Nashville. I was able to do that. I wanted to get inside of the Tribune Company, which is the only corporation in the United States that owns both a newspaper and a television station in Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, the three major markets. Now, you know from what I just told you that should be against the rules, but the Tribune has managed to get the FCC's permission to do it anyway. They've gotten special waivers in the case of Chicago that their holdings were grandfathered in. I wanted to understand how do companies like this work. I wanted to understand the New Times Village Voice Corporation, which as you know now controls about 40% of the market for alt weeklies, including I believe the Nashville Scene. So they're right here. But that wasn't all. I wanted to get so there's what's happening inside these corporations. It's very difficult to penetrate the walls surrounding big media companies. So that took a lot of work. But I did it eventually. But I also wanted to get inside of another world, this kind of exclusive domain of policymakers. So I interviewed FCC commissioners. I interviewed FCC staffers. I interviewed congressional officials, congressional representatives. How do we make media policy in this country? How does that operate? I needed to know. And then I also wanted to understand what civic groups are doing, what ordinary citizens are doing. How have we all been affected by this transformation? What, if anything, have we done? And to do that, I spent time talking to people from New York to Santa Barbara to Monterey to a little town near here called Pasquale, outside of Nashville, and I'll return to the story of what happened there very soon. And let me just preview by telling you what I found is, on the one hand, profoundly disturbing. Profoundly disturbing, in ways that I hope to describe in real detail. But I also want to tell you that what I discovered is utterly inspiring in ways that were totally unexpected to me. And that the ultimate message I want to bring to you tonight is one of hope, because I think we're at one of the most exciting moments in media that I've ever seen or read about. There's really exciting stuff happening. So the book is, on the one hand, the story of how major media companies have devastated our rich tradition in this country of local competition, of local media, of diverse local media markets. But it's also the story of how an impassioned and empowered group of citizens at the local level and also at the national level have organized a movement for media reform, one that I guarantee has penetrated Nashville already, and will move further ahead in years to come. You should also know what's exciting about this movement, and what I think is so amazing about the call to change the way that our media system operates, is that it's not like it's this one particular part of the political spectrum that's advocating for it, and they're off in a little corner in their own world. The groups that have been part of the movement to do something about consolidation, about the loss and vitality in our local media markets includes the NRA, the Christian Coalition, economic libertarians. You'd be hard-pressed to find more inspired writing about the issue of media consolidation than William Sapphire in the New York Times. But it also includes Common Cause and MoveOn.org and Free Press and the ACLU and Code Pink. And my view is basically, if you can get the Christian Coalition and Code Pink to agree on the same thing, and it turns out that the NRA and the ACLU are also there, this is worth paying attention to, my friends. Something is going on here. But here's the thing. I feel like one problem we suffer from in this debate when we have it is that media consolidation is often portrayed as this utterly abstract phenomenon. It exists up in the stratosphere. And it's very difficult for any of us to connect the dots and see the consequences for our daily lives. So do you remember reading the news years ago that GE was acquiring NBC, or that Disney was acquiring ABC and with it dozens of other companies, or that so-and-so merged with da-da-da? I mean, my eyes glaze over reading these stories. Or I don't know, have any of you ever seen those charts? They're in magazines sometimes. They have the five giant media corporations that run the media system, and then there's these big companies, and then they all have spider webs, and from the webs there are 30, 40, 50 companies, some you've heard of, some you haven't. And you read these things and you think, whoa, this is awesome. I have no idea what this means. And I'm a media scholar. I spend my time, my life, trying to sort this out, and it's totally confusing and disorienting. And what I've discovered is that the way to make this issue kind of hit home is to shift the scale of the conversation. And so what I want to talk about today is not so much what it means when one giant corporation buys another, though I think we shouldn't forget about that. But I want to ask you to think about what has happened to your local media. What's happened to your newspaper? I understand that the Tennessean was a privately owned newspaper until 1979, when it became part of the Gannett family. Oh, boy, now it sounds like I'm actually being amplified. Is that better? That sounds better. What's happened to your local radio stations in the last 10 years? Have you noticed a change in the sound? What's happened to your local television program? Have you noticed changes in your Alt Weekly? If you think about your travels around the country, if you're maybe you're like me, you tend to go to other cities and you turn on the radio or you pick up the newspaper and try to get a feel for what's going on. Have you noticed any differences? What's your sense of the health and the vitality of our local media? Fighting for Air tries to go to that scale because I think this is the way that we can humanize this story. And in humanizing it, I want to remind us of why we think about these public interest obligations, why we originally set them into law, and why we might consider reviving the idea that the media have some special public interest obligations and public service obligations. And then we might talk about how we could have a better media system than the one we have today. I have to say, I talked to hundreds of people in the course of the 5 years in which I did this work. And not a single person said to me, "Eric, my chain newspaper is so great today. I love the way that Gannett covers my town. I just, those wire stories that they run really, they really illuminate them. I just need to say this. I don't know what you feel about the Tennessean, but like I said, I go to town and I pick up the newspaper. I arrived yesterday on Sunday, and so I got the Tennessean, and I went to the front page, and it seemed to me that there were three stories in the entire front page section that were written by staff reporters from the Tennessean, and literally every other story was wire copy. Not a single person I talked to said, boy, is my newspaper better now that a chain took it over. I didn't talk to anyone who said, music radio, it used to just bore me, but I love what happened when Clear Channel came and bought it. I mean, it's great. I love their programming. There's this one song I love, and I've heard it 8,000 times since then. I haven't heard a single person say that to me. I mean, I think one nice thing about consolidation of television is you can go to cities across the country, and you know exactly what time to tune into the news program if you want to get the weather or the sports or the bloody murder story. I mean, it doesn't matter what city you're in, they're always on at the same time. I guess it has that advantage, but I can't tell you the level of dissatisfaction I heard around this, and it's by kind of illustrating this that I think we learned something. And let me say one other thing about the local focus of our discussion tonight. I know that we live in a global era that when you take seminars, if you're a student, no one talks about the local. I mean, what could be more boring than localism, right? I mean, ew. But these are global times. But no matter how cosmopolitan you are, no matter how many times you get on a jet plane every week, I would guess that most of us live profoundly local lives. That our fate is wrapped up with the fate of our school board, with the work of our city government. When there's a company that's polluting in our hometown, that matters to us. If there's corruption with a local business, if a local business is going to lay off lots of people, that affects our lives. This stuff matters. This stuff really matters. And local media matter not only because they cover things at that level, but also because local media play a special role not just in coverage, but in literally creating communities. And this is a long-standing theme from my field of research sociology. Robert Park, who's a major figure in the history of American urban sociology, was also a newspaper man. And Robert Park documented the ways in which when new people came to the city in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the newspaper served an integrating function. It created a shared set of stories and ideas. It changed the mental world. That's what Richard Hofstadter, the great historian, said. It changed the mental world for people by giving us the information we needed to connect our lives to those of others. Again, we live in a time where there's tremendous immigration and migration. I know that Nashville is changing dramatically. All of our cities have changed. It's not like we don't need this. Tocqueville actually said, without newspapers, we would have hardly any common action at all. We need some kind of integrating function. Local media are also important. They serve as eyes on the city. Jane Jacobs, you know, the great urban scholar, used to talk about the ways that in cities operate because they have their eyes on the streets, their eyes on the sidewalk. People look out for one another. They make sure the public is safe. Well, newspapers, news media, radio reporters in the days that they existed, television news, it does a similar thing, right? They're eyes on the city. And you benefit from watchdogs even if you don't pick up the paper. Because if you're a government official, if you're a local business person, you're careful about the way you act if you know that there's someone out there scrutinizing local institutions. You don't want to be caught. in their x-ray.
And local media and local action matters in another way too, because if you think about it, even the most global stories of our time, the most global issues, percolate up from the local level. You think of the famous reporting on the civil rights movement. That starts at the local level and comes up and becomes a national story. There was a journalist named Randy Schiltz working for the San Francisco Chronicle in the 1970s, early 1980s. He started to notice that a lot of his men in the gay community in San Francisco were getting sick with strange illnesses, and he began writing stories about what became known as HIV/AIDS. That was a local story, but it wasn't so local, was it? What about Boston, the sex abuse scandal in the church system? There was a local story that turned out not to be local after all. If you don't have local media that follows what's happening in your hometown, you get Houston, right? I mean, it wasn't the Houston Chronicle business reporters who discovered what was happening with Enron. The coverage came way after the fact, after it was too late. These things really do matter. And the kind of bottom line thing that I discovered looking across media, and one thing that I'm tremendously concerned about in the country today, is the loss of local voices. The loss of local voices. I think a cost of consolidation is the net loss of journalists covering our cities for our newspapers, the net loss of local DJs and talk show hosts, even the net loss of personalities in television. So let me tell you about a story that I think really vividly illustrates this problem. It's a story that has a lot of buzz around it. People talk about it quite often at a superficial level, but no one, I think, has really told the story with the depth it deserves. It's a story of Minot, North Dakota. How many of you have heard of Minot, North Dakota? Yeah, so really just a small number of people. Well, on the surface, there might not be much reason for you to know about Minot, North Dakota. It's a small town, about 37,000 people. In a pretty small state that's pretty far from here. But exactly 5 years ago this month, on January 18th, 2002, a train derailed in the early morning hours and spilled about 240,000 gallons of anhydrous ammonia. That's a highly toxic chemical that can burn your throat, your respiratory system, your eyes, your skin. If it's inhaled in sufficient doses, it can be deadly. And there was so much of this gas spilled that the toxins formed a cloud that was literally 5 miles long, 1.5 miles wide, and 300 feet high, and the cloud started floating through the town. It penetrated into the homes of 15,000 people in this town. And people were quite anxious. It was just after September 11th. Many people thought the town was under attack. The people had trouble breathing. I actually got, in the course of doing research for the book, the phone call, the audio files of the phone calls, and also the transcripts of every single phone call made to 911 that night, to 911 that night. I was going to play them for you tonight, but I decided not to do that. And people were gasping for air, asking for help. And in fact, people needed instructions on what to do, because your immediate response to a gas spill might be to try to get away from it, get as far away as possible, even if that means going through it. But in fact, it's very difficult to go through it. You do tremendous amount of damage trying to go through it. And the best thing you can do is to stay inside, to try to seal off your windows, find a room and seal it up, preferably a bathroom, and run water and just make sure you're not breathing in the chemical. Well, how do you get this information out? In this country, since the Cold War, the way you get information out during an emergency like this is you use the radio system, use the broadcast system. It was President Truman's plan he developed the Conelrad system. Some of you in the room might remember this. And the idea was that the most fundamental and basic public service obligation that the radio companies have as condition for getting their licenses to use the airwaves is to be emergency broadcasters when we need them most. And so we tried to set up a system in this country to do that effectively. Conelrad ended and was replaced by the emergency broadcast system, which probably all of us, or most of us, I hope the undergraduates who are here remember the emergency broadcast system, but you remember that famous kind of announcement, and we could all probably say it together. And this is a test of the emergency broadcast system. This is only a test. On television stations and radio stations, we remember that well. In the 1990s, it was replaced with the emergency alert system, which should allow local officials to automatically override broadcast stations. In Minot, the local officials that night tried to use the emergency alert system, but it malfunctioned. It was a new system at the time, and they couldn't get it implemented. There's a debate about, you know, what went wrong, but the thing didn't work. So they did the next best thing, which is they picked up the telephone and they called the radio station that was the designated emergency broadcaster, KCJB 910 AM, and they wanted to get the message out. You know, there's been this spill. You got to get on the radio, issue an alert, because people were calling in. You know, there were hundreds of calls from that night of people asking what to do. They called the station, and let the phone ring, and no one ever answered. They couldn't get through to anyone at the station. There was a reason why they couldn't get through to anyone at the station. There was one company, Clear Channel, that owned all six of the commercial and non-religious stations in Minot. They had replaced lots of the local staff with automated programming. And this is one of the things that happens when you have a big media system that runs on consolidators. When you have a big company, you try to improve the business model by increasing the efficiency of the organization and keeping your costs down. And so when Clear Channel and other radio consolidators bought out a number of radio stations in this country, they began replacing local staff, local DJs, local talk show hosts with automated programs, even local people who would work the offices. So it wasn't uncommon for stations to have automated programming running, but there was literally no one there to answer the phone and issue an alert. And so I actually have the files from that night. You can hear people screaming, and in the background is the same voices, the same kind of canned music, smooth-talking DJs sailing you through the night while a toxic cloud hovers overhead. And you could hardly imagine anything more profoundly alienating and estranging than being in the midst of a disaster, needing information to figure out how to stay safe, and having this canned content, to watch the videotapes I have, or to listen to the soundtracks. It's really horrific. Now, until 1996, it was illegal for any company to own more than four stations in a given market. Like I said, until the early 1980s, you actually couldn't own more than one AM and one FM station. It was also illegal to own more than 40 stations nationally. And the result of this is that the radio industry had a lot of relatively small players in it. It was a highly competitive industry. There were no giants. In the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which was pushed very hard into law by the Republican Congress, this was the first term of the Congress that went in 1994, Newt Gingrich's Contract with America Congress. But it was also, it's important, really important to note, for the partisans out there, it was signed into law enthusiastically by President Bill Clinton and supported by Al Gore. They eliminated the national ownership cap altogether and raised the local cap from 4 to 8. And within 2 years, literally within 2 years, 40% of the nation's commercial broadcast radio stations were bought or sold. They changed hands. And a couple of giant corporations emerged literally from out of nowhere. The Clear Channel being by far the largest. It by 2000 had more than 1,200 stations in its holding. In other words, these changes were made possible by law. They were there by design. And the story in Minot is only extreme in that the gases were released that night and people were especially at risk. And in fact, a consolidated radio system where local reporters, local DJs, local talk show hosts were eliminated and replaced by syndicated shows and by voice track shows became the norm. There's tremendous efficiency in doing this. You need to understand that many people are kind of technological enthusiasts. The idea is that all these great digital new technologies have created a totally vibrant media landscape, given us a number of choices. The internet has changed our lives, and all that's true in many levels. But digital technologies have also enabled big media companies to do things with standardized programming that never before would have been possible. For example, Clear Channel acquired the company Profit Systems. I tell the story of Profit in my book, that pioneered voice tracking systems, basically computer programs that allowed a programmer sitting in an office anywhere in the world to put together a four-hour air shift in about 20 minutes. And so rather than having one DJ work a full shift, you know, four hours plus all the time before and after, the company could literally have offices full of centralized programmers who would do 8, 10, 12 shifts, full shifts in one day's work. And the savings were tremendous. It helped to make radio a far more profitable business. They also began faking local broadcasts. I'm sure you've heard stories about this. Radio hosts who would sit in a room pretending to be in cities where, in fact, they had never visited, talking about events that they had not experienced firsthand, advertising competitions as local competitions when, in fact, they were national. This became fairly widespread, and I try to document this. And you should also know that MyNet is not the only disaster story that stems from the loss of real human beings in our radio studios. I tell the story of what happened in Syracuse, New York during the blackout of August 2003. David Rubin, the dean of the communications school at Syracuse, saw that the power went out. He wanted to find out what was going on. Couldn't use his internet, couldn't use the computer, couldn't use the television, obviously. Got in his car, started to drive home, turned on the radio, tuned into his local radio news station. It also was owned by Clear Channel, which owns 7 radio stations plus a TV station in town. And what was he getting? News reports about the subway system in New York City, because the Clear Channel's operations in Syracuse didn't have people to report on what was happening in Syracuse. There just wasn't enough information there. So this is bad news during disaster. There's no question about that. But consolidation in the radio industry has had more insidious effects on everyday programming and on everyday ownership issues, on the everyday structure of the industry, and my guess is you can hear the difference. And let me tell you that one community that's clearly heard the difference is the community I discussed before. It's not really a community, but the population of African Americans and Latinos in this country, because a cost of consolidation is that it became very difficult for smaller, more independent radio stations to do business with the giant consolidators. And they didn't just own the radio stations, they own more. I'll explain this to you. So what happened to minority-owned broadcast stations since 1996? Well, according to a very recent study released by Free Press, there's been a net loss of 40% of minority-owned broadcast stations and female-owned broadcast stations since the deregulatory push in the 1990s. Today, 33% minority population, 3% of our nation's broadcast stations are owned by minorities. About 51% of the population is female, and about 5% of broadcast stations are owned by women. These are issues that are appropriate to talk about on Martin Luther King Day. These are civil rights issues. These are human rights issues, because they're about our access to speak and be represented in an equal way. They're about equal access. And we need to deal with them. The FCC is by law required to create policies that have absolutely the opposite effect, that diversify the airwaves, that include rather than exclude. And they have failed to do this. This story works one way in numbers, but I think it really hits home when you look at some of the individual cases of people who've been affected by laws like this. And one of the people I talked to in the course of writing Fighting for Air is a man named Robert Short, also in Syracuse, New York. And Robert Short's an African-American guy. Robert Short Jr. is his full name. He grew up in Syracuse, and he was a big music lover. You know, there are a lot of people. I don't know if this is as true for younger people today. And when I teach undergraduates and I ask, you know, how many of you listen to the radio? And I think, sadly, consolidation has actually pushed so many people off the airwaves. I think the big radio companies, by saturating the air with 20 minutes of commercial per hour and the same songs that go over and over again, they basically pushed us to our MP3s and our iPods and the internet. I don't know if radio is as irrelevant as it once was. I think we need to think about how to make it more relevant. But for a lot of us, we grew up listening to radio, and radio became this tremendous lifeline. It connected us to other people at times when we felt like we had our own weird tastes and we didn't quite fit in. I mean, you'd go to radio and find a DJ who played the kind of music you liked or who had your kind of personality, or you'd find a talk show person who talked like you and had your values, and suddenly you were connected to something bigger. This actually, I mean, this still really operates today. Well, Robert Troy felt like that, except for he was really frustrated in Syracuse. There were no black-owned radio stations, even though it's got a sizable black population. And he always felt like the radio didn't really have a soul. He said, there was no heartbeat, even in the black stations, the stations that played African American music, they just didn't really have a heartbeat. And he went away to college, and he said, it's my dream when I come back here to return to Syracuse and start my own radio business. And actually, for a time, the FCC recognized that there was a real need to get more minority owners, and they set up special processes through which minorities could apply for licenses. It was very expensive. It's expensive to start up a full power station and to staff it and to get the equipment together. But Robert Church Jr. went into debt. He built up a station and he started his own rhythm and blues station in 1995. It went on the air. And it was such a glorious event for him, he said. He talked about how happy he was to get up and running with the station. He wanted not just to do this kind of music, but he also said he really wanted to do positive programming that was good for his community in Syracuse, that he wanted to do a lot of community events, and he sponsored picnics and festivals. He got involved in the school system. He said, you know, the broadcast station can really do wonderful things. And he loved doing it. And then 1996, the Telecom Act came, and suddenly the whole industry changed. Clear Channel came to town, they started buying stations. And he said, what was so difficult for me when we talked, he said, what was so difficult for me is, he said, you have to understand, it's not just the 1,200 stations and the 7 stations in my market. He said, what people don't know is Clear Channel also owns Premier Radio Networks, and that is the largest syndicator of radio programs in the country. You might have heard of a small program called The Rush Limbaugh Show, or Dr. Laura, enormously popular programs. And actually, Clear Channel programs through Premier Radio Networks play on about 6,000 stations across the country, which means the majority of commercial radio stations in this country depend on Clear Channel for their programming. And so if you're a competitor of Clear Channel, they come into your market, suddenly it can become difficult to get their stations if they decide they want to put their programs, to get those syndicated programs, if they want to put it on their stations. And he said, but Eric, you have to understand that's not all. Because it's not just the stations and the syndicators, they also own the Katz Media Services Advertising Group, and they sell these advertising packages to local businesses. And they don't just own the radio station. He said, Clear Channel is also the largest owner of outdoor advertising space around. You have billboards everywhere, Clear Channel billboards. And so when people go out and the advertising groups go out there, they sell these packages. And he said, Eric, they also own a television station here. So I couldn't compete. And in 2000, he sold his station, which he had worked so hard to acquire, to kind of a mid-sized chain. And today he's selling gift baskets. And I think that's a real loss to his community. In incalculable ways. And there are, sadly, I think, stories like Robert Short's story everywhere you go. Now, there are other people in the music business who are concerned about what's happened to radio, because they said the radio, and music radio in particular, is a key part of our cultural ecosystem. So one thing that's so important about American culture that we need to understand is the robustness of local music scenes. And the way in which, when we think about cities, we can immediately identify a special kind of sound. So if I say to you the word Philadelphia, you probably hear Philadelphia, right? If I say to you Detroit, I bet you hear Detroit, New Orleans, Chicago, San Francisco, Nashville. You can hear that city. But a cost of consolidation, and you hear this from people in the creative community, from the music community, and everywhere you go, is that the airwaves take space away from local bands. It makes it very difficult for local artists to get themselves heard on the air. And it's as if you kind of choke a part of our of our informational arteries, of our cultural arteries. And you take away the possibility that some great band that sounds interesting and new and different is going to get itself heard by a local DJ who takes it as his mission or her mission in life to break new artists, to discover things from the place where they live, and get it out in the airwaves, and then play it and get it pushed up to the national level, and then maybe the international level. And in the book, I tell stories of DJs who take pride in having broken different bands. That's a very different kind of cultural ecosystem than the cultural ecosystem in which the way to get on the air is to go before a big national radio giant and pay them through an indie promoter $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 for a chance to get a shot to be heard by them and to get a shot to be on their program list and have it go top down through the company. Right? That's a very different model. And think about it. I mean, where are the cities since 1996? Can you think about the sound of a city? What cities have really changed our musical landscape? Since Seattle and grunge, it's hard to come up with something like that. And there's an organization called the Recording Artists Coalition, which has some of the top name music performers in the industry, and they have taken radio consolidation as their cause because they say, in their words, consolidation in music radio has done cultural damage to us. Someone said, if Clear Channel controlled the radio industry in 1950 the way it does today, we would all still be listening to Frank Sinatra. And in a way that there's something to that. I mean, why is it that every single one of us, including the youngest person in the room, and surely every undergraduate, can sing the song to every classic rock song from the 1960s, can sing the words to every classic rock song? We have the same vocabulary of songs. It's not because there's no new music that's coming out. It's not because there are no new, good, interesting bands. It's because it's so hard to hear them on the air. And this is a story of what's happened with the radio. And again, you go to any city today, and you turn on the radio, and you'll find Kiss FM and the Magic and Golden Oldies. You know the name of the brands, even. We have big brand radio, and it hurts. So I want to just turn the story, because this, in fact, is the prelude to, I think, what's a much better story. And I'm not going to say much. I really want to have a conversation after this. What's exciting to me about this moment is I think that after a decade of this relentless consolidation, Americans, no matter who they are, no matter where they're from, no matter whether they live in a red state or a blue state, if they're ardent right-wing conservative Republicans, if they're wild left-wing progressives, they said, enough. We want our local voices back. We want a more interesting cultural environment, and consolidation has not served our interests. One of the most exciting things that I've found, and that I did not expect to be so excited by, is the emergence of people who said, to hell with it. If they won't give me the kind of programming I need, I'm going to build my own radio station and do it myself. And we have seen in the last several years the emergence of the low-power FM radio movement, of organizations around the country that said, we're going to put up our own radio tower, we're going to get licenses, and we're going to push the FCC to allow us to get licenses as much as we can, and we're going to do our own programming. And there's a national organization called the Prometheus Radio Project. Have any of you heard of Prometheus? Can you raise your hand if you've heard of Prometheus? I mean, this is an organization that started a group of anarchists in Philadelphia who did a pirate radio station called Radio Mutiny out of the basement of a house. They got busted by the FCC, they did a whole series of annexes, an amazing story about them that involves everything from marching in front of the Benjamin Franklin printing press statue in Philadelphia, where they openly invited the FCC to come and arrest them, to marching in D.C. at the National Association of Broadcasters, and while no one was looking, taking down the NAB flag and hoisting a Jolly Roger over it. They turned themselves into Prometheus. They said, you can bust us, but if you bust Radio Mutiny, we are going to start 5 LPFM stations for everyone you take down. And they go around the country helping people set up stations. And I want to say this, because one of the best experiences I've had in years, I had a great time, and I also felt like I did something meaningful as I came to Nashville. And I participated only a little bit and mostly observed the making of Radio Free Nashville. On a rainy weekend that felt a little bit like this, I watched this group, this extraordinary group of people, including Ginny Welsh, who I see here, including April Glazer and Ed Glazer, put up this radio station and do it themselves. And it's an amazing thing, and it's a little thing, but it's a thing that fills you with tremendous hope. And I think we live in a time that's very difficult. There are a lot of us who feel pretty gloomy about the state of the world today, about the state of our culture today, about the state of our country today, and there are few things that can make your life more meaningful and full of hope than spending time with people who dedicated themselves to making a better media. Are there other people from Radio Free Nashville here? Can you stand up if there are people from there?
From there?
Yeah.
Bell.
Yeah, can you raise your hand if you're from Radio Free Nashville?
If
you don't know about it, I urge you go online and check out what Radio Free Nashville done. I mean, it's a little thing, but it's an enormous thing. You should also know that this is an exciting moment. In April and May this year, for the first time in about 20 years, the FCC is opening up a new process, and they are they're auctioning off full power FM stations for the first time in decades. It's an amazing moment, and so people have a chance to get licensed for their own FM station. It's an interesting thing. You should think about doing it. But the bigger movement actually has been not just doing independent media, but also dealing with the urgent media policy issues of our time, of really stepping up to the plate and saying, let's do something to make sure that when we make media policy in this country, we do it in a more democratic manner. And it happened, it really came together in 2003 and 2004. Michael Powell, Colin Powell's son, was the chairman of the FCC at the time, and he said, I want to totally change the way that we structure the regulation in the media industry. We are going to massively deregulate. We're going to get rid of the cross-ownership ban. We are going to raise the television ownership cap. We were going to try to raise the radio ownership cap. We're really going to change the way we do things here. Organizations throughout the country said, no, you know, don't do this to our media. And this is when all of these groups came together. And literally 3 million people wrote letters to Congress and the FCC in 2003 and 2004. And Congressman Cooper can tell us, there are not a lot of issues where 3 million people write letters to Congress and the FCC. And when 3 million people do, they pay attention. Now, the FCC did not pay attention. Michael Powell pushed through this order despite the overwhelming public opposition. But then a U.S. appellate court said, well, we hear that there's something going on. There was a legal challenge. It was Prometheus, these anarchists in Philadelphia, Prometheus versus the FCC. A number of groups came together in the case, and lo and behold, the FCC lost. The court remanded the decision. They said, your rationale is not sound. And this was amazing because this is a very important thing to know. When the FCC has made decisions about media ownership and Congress has made decisions on media ownership, they've done it by using the rhetoric of science. And Michael Powell and now the new chairman, Kevin Martin, has said, we don't have to listen to what the public says, because we have expertise, we have technical sophistication, we have science on our side, and we will make media policy through sound scientific judgments. And so if you read the FCC's order and you look at their science, you will find scientific discoveries such as the following. In New York City, you want to understand what media organizations are the most influential. And according to the FCC science, the Dutchess Community College public access television station is more influential than the New York Times. That was one bit of FCC science, and when the court made its decision, it said, excuse me? Let me give you another bit of FCC science. The FCC commissioned some studies on local ownership. Michael Powell was committed to the proposition, to the finding, that local ownership does not improve the quality of television news. It doesn't improve the localism of television news. So the FCC did a study, and the study showed that actually when a local company owns a television station, they air 5 minutes more local news and information per episode, per night, than when the station is owned by a chain from out of town. But you didn't hear that study, because what happened to that study is that the FCC suppressed it. They literally suppressed it. It did not see the light of day until just a few months ago, when in the confirmation hearings for Kevin Martin, his reconfirmation hearings, Senator Barbara Boxer from California pulled out this study that had been leaked to her and said, where did this go? How did it get suppressed? And it was one of the most humiliating experiences you'll ever see a commissioner or a chairman have. The FCC suppressed findings it didn't like. this is not the scientific method. There was no peer review. The scientific method does not call for burying results when they don't fit the policy line you want to make. It is totally illegitimate for us to be intimidated by FCC so-called science. It's wrong for them to foist it on us in this way. In my view, it's time for a more robust public conversation. I'm going to close on this point. I just came from Memphis, Tennessee, a few hours from here. Well, I would say a few hours, but in yesterday's weather, it was like a 3 days travel from here. I came from Memphis, Tennessee. It was the National Conference for Media Reform. There were 3,000 people who came and paid their own way from around the country to spend a weekend in January in Memphis to talk about this issue. It was really quite extraordinary. And the sentiment in the room was extremely optimistic. We're the people who came together at the Media National Conference on Media Reform were realists. They read, like I did, the recent study that showed that major telecommunications and media companies have spent a little less than $500 million on just political contributions to both political parties between 1997 and 2006. That's a lot of money. Ed Markey, who's about to chair the House Committee on Communications, Telecommunications in this next Congress, said to me, said to all of us, I'd never heard this, that the media industry assigns a personal lobbyist to every single member of Congress. So there is a lot to deal with. It's not like these issues are over, and the network neutrality debate is live, the media ownership debate is live, all of these things are happening. And in fact, over the next 6 months, look for the FCC and Congress to make major decisions. But at the same time, I think that a growing number of people have decided we've had enough of this. It's time for a change. And I think now is a time for all of us who feel this way, and I certainly do, to say enough. And so I invite you to ask any question that you want about the things I've said, about the book. But I also invite you, at the end of the day, to go home and think about what it is that you want from your media in the future, and don't be shy about sharing your opinion. Thank you very much.
I'm going to take questions for about 15 minutes, and Eric, I'll just let you field questions rather than calling out for you.
Sure. I'd be happy to, and just to be clear, if you feel like your question's not answered sufficiently, or if you don't get a chance to speak, I know there's a reception afterwards, and I'll be out signing books and things like that, so feel free to continue the conversation. Yes?
What is your opinion of the future of newspapers, given the internet and given the impact of TV? Will they survive?
Yeah, I'm quite concerned about the future of newspapers. I have to say that my greatest concern is actually the future of newspaper journalism. It's not so much the print that matters to me. It's about the quality of journalism that only the newspaper industry has really been able to sustain over time. And there's a chapter in the book that's about the newspaper industry. And I think the state of the newspaper industry is really a mixed story. And I know that might be hard for you to believe, because the story we get about the newspaper industry is that it is collapsing, and collapsing fast. In some ways, there's no doubt that that's true. The value of newspaper stock has gone down about 20% in the last couple of years. But if you look from a longer perspective, over a 10-year period, actually, the value of newspaper stocks, for the most part, are up. I mean, I've tried to look at this over a longer perspective. Excuse me. But there's no question that newspaper managers face tremendous pressure from shareholders and from investment bankers. But what I think is important to understand is the real problem for newspapers come from unrealistic expectations on the business that in a way they themselves have established. And there's no company that's more responsible for setting those unrealistic expectations than Gannett. Let me go back a second. The average profit margin of a Fortune 500 company in this country is about 5 or 6% per year. Probably some of you read newspaper stories about the tremendous profits from the oil industry. Last year, remember, there was a time we were told that the oil industry was in crisis. The cost of of gas prices went way up, and then it turned out that, that oil companies had made record-breaking profits. The profit margins for the oil companies were about 15%. Newspaper companies today expect or hope to get somewhere between 20 and 30% profit margins. And I presume that many of you have heard about the crisis at the LA Times and the, you know, the way that which the Tribune Company, their owner now, has just downsized aggressively. Well, the LA Times in this moment of crisis is returning 20% profit margins. I'm sure that many of you heard that Knight Ridder was forced to sell because shareholders were upset that its revenues were not sufficient. Well, Knight Ridder sold, and it was turning profit margins in the high teens. The newspaper industry in 2004 generated about $47 billion in revenue. And it's a largely cash business, unlike many other businesses, because the money's coming in from advertisers at a fairly steady clip. Moreover, newspapers still have the readership and the kind of dedicated readership of the most valuable part of the market, the, you know, key city leaders, affluent people, the most educated people, the power elite are newspaper readers in every city. And another thing you need to know about newspapers, which is that they control the most popular websites, local websites, in almost every city. So what website gets you the most, you know, hits? It's almost certainly newspaper.com, no matter where you live. That's where you go for local news. So circulation in newspapers is falling. It's been falling at a fairly steady clip. But if you look at the Newspaper Association of America's own data, and actually they've been very vocal about this, newspaper journalism has never been so influential or ubiquitous, because the way the web works is it actually sets up an echo chamber for newspaper journalists, which means their work is amplified in many different sites. And if you look at circulation in terms of who buys a printed page, which is what they need to look at right now because of the business model, circulation's down. If you look at circulation in terms of who looks at articles, who's reading stories, and here's the data, newspaper circulation has never been higher. The challenge for the newspaper industry is to weather out the storm, and the storm comes from investors. They are very quickly discovering ways to make money off the internet. It's not fully satisfying, but you should know that in the past year, every major urban newspaper has set up a new advertising agreement to work with either Google or Yahoo. They're on it now. Now, they're setting up classified systems online. They're about 10 years too late. I mean, had the newspaper industry been more forward-thinking, they could have dealt with this problem and been much better prepared than they are right now. That's an issue. But the newspaper industry, in my view, is very well poised to be a leader in journalism, in media, as we move into the digital age. So I think that on the one hand, the managers are right to express concern. They face a beating from investment bankers. But here's the Gannett story. I mean, Gannett is the company that Gannett owns, last time I checked, 99 newspapers across the country, plus a bunch of television stations. Many of you know that the Tribune Company has put itself up for auction, and Gannett is one of the companies that people speculate could take over Tribune, and that would make it even bigger. Gannett essentially set up a business model that the newspaper industry has adopted everywhere, which involves you move into a market, you do everything possible to try to take out your competitor. And there were lots of antitrust cases filed against Gannett, some actually victorious, where newspapers complained that the pricing structure of the advertising was unfair, that they could no longer compete, they closed down. And once Gannett set up a monopoly in the newspaper market, they started downsizing the newsroom, replacing the local staff with wire copy. I mean, they basically did what you see to your Tennessean all over the country. And this, it's hard to make the case that this was good for communities, but it certainly lifted the Gannett bottom line. And the profit margins of Gannett papers were unbelievably high. About 50 years ago, 80% of American cities had locally owned and operated newspapers. Today, 80% of American cities have newspapers run by chains. And almost every city has a monopoly market in newspapers. So it's not like if the Gannett starts to shed its employees that you have another local newspaper to turn to. And this is bad. This is bad for democracy. We need to know what's happening. We need those eyes on the streets. So there are all sorts of interesting debates going on right now about what to do about this. In LA, you probably heard there are a bunch of billionaires who are thinking about, well, maybe we could buy the LA Times back. In Philadelphia, a group of very wealthy people did buy the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News. Is locally owned and operated newspapers the thing of the future? Do we need this for democracy? Should the government be thinking about ways to support or subsidize local journalism, because the market is clearly failing on this score? Those, I think, are fascinating debates, but I have to admit, I look for newspapers to survive this difficult time, but I do think it's a difficult time. Yes, in the back.
Two questions. First question is, if you looked at other regulatory environments for control like Canada, to see what the media environment like generally happened. The second question is, what about the notion of the long tail? Chris Anderson's notion from Wired magazine that we're increasingly going away from a nation of hits, you know, the 80-20 rule, to a nation of niches, where most people through tools like Google find the niche that they want, much like the discussion we had about radio and you know, the reemergence of the sole radio broadcast.
Yeah. Well, I have studied the telecommunications law in different places. It's not a major theme of the book. I mean, the thing to know about the United States is, I think that I really want to emphasize, is that we have long relied on the corporate sector to provide most of our media, and that really does make us distinct from a number of other places. Our investment in public broadcasting and public media compared to almost every comparable country is minuscule. Our public investment in the arts is minuscule. We have long relied on the corporate sector to do this. Now, we have relied on the corporate sector, but we have also exacted a special price from corporations, which was simply to serve these public interest obligations. And in recent years, the push really came first from Reagan, you know, who tried to get rid of a lot of the public service requirements, including children's programming and the special time slots in prime hours or pre-prime hours that were designated for programs that dealt with local material. We got rid of those legal restrictions, and so the big change now is we have a corporate system that's kind of run amok, and a system that allows for too much concentration and not enough competition at the local level. And that, I think it's worth emphasizing, is why the economic libertarians like William Safire, you would not think would be calling for regulation, are calling for regulation. They said, well, we currently in this country do not have enough competition at the local level. And this is a great myth about the internet. I think it's really important to emphasize this point, that the case for gutting ownership law typically comes down to this point that with the internet, we now have access to more information than ever before, that we are saturated with information, we are saturated with culture. And that might be true in some areas. I mean, I can get news from all sorts of places in the world that I never could get news from before. I can get cultural programming that I probably couldn't get before from all over the place. But it certainly is not true at the local level. You cannot make the argument with any evidence that there is more local journalism, that there are more local talk show hosts, that there are more local DJs, that there are more local news television staffers who are out there digging up information. And this is a real loss. And that's why people who care about regulation are so concerned about this issue. And that's why people, I think, who care about competitive and healthy markets are concerned about this. And so there's one area where we are really off at one end of the distribution. Now, the long tail, I think this is a kind of clever idea, and it's certainly fashionable. And it's the kind of idea that media companies love to tell us. You'll note, for example, you know, that you are unlikely to see me on the Today Show anytime soon making arguments like this. You are probably not going to hear me on Premier Radio Network. I am unlikely to appear on Clear Channel. I don't expect to be front page news tomorrow in the Tennessean. But when there's an intellectual who makes an argument like Anderson in The Long Tail, which says basically we don't need to worry about this because the media system works for all of us, it's amazing how much the media want to cover that story. The problem with the long tail argument for me is that it presumes that information is there to begin with. And if you'll note, what the changes I'm talking about have to do with the elimination of the cultural producers who make this stuff in the first place, and who can make it viable for their lives. So, for example, you don't need to get paid to do journalism. You might decide to do a City Hall beat on your own time, and to spend 8, 10, 12 hours a day digging up information about what's happening in your city government, and to learn how to do that kind of research. And you might buy your own LexisNexis system, and you might have a blog that covers this all. But you better be really wealthy if you're going to do this, because it's going to cost you a lot of money. You're probably not going to be able to have a job. And so the end story is that you don't do it. And so there is just no compensating for the loss of information which comes after this kind of downsizing. Let me give you one dramatic example where I think the long tail argument really doesn't work. And I'll go back to journalism. Action at the State House. Action in state government. If you follow politics, you know that one of the big shifts in governance over the last couple of decades has been the delegation of power, the devolution of power from the federal government to the local government level. And the corporate sector is very well aware of it. In fact, if you track lobbying expenditures at state government, you'll see the skyrocketing of interest. And even the corporate culture of state capitals has transformed. Big new hotels and beautiful restaurants and kind of bougie culture that's emerged. Well, they love it there because the newspapers left. When newspapers downsized, they pulled their state house reporters. And so the newsrooms in state houses are ghost towns compared to what they used to be. Now, I don't care about the long tail argument for old movies produced by Hollywood. There's no long tail that gets you to the news that was never produced in the first place. There's no long tail that gets you to the local DJ who used to promote local bands who lost his job. There are no local bands who are playing music for a living if there's no vibrant local music scene that is a viable pathway up to a career. Eventually, you do something else, right? You go to work in advertising because you couldn't make it as a musician. And I'm concerned about the lost cultural products that we'll never know about.
We'll take one very quick. The question can be long, but the answer has to be short.
It's a deal.
There is right after this question, there is food and drink on the other side of this wall. So we want to finish up here, and Eric will be available for a good amount of time during the reception, so that those of you that didn't get a chance to ask a question can do so as we mingle in the outside hallway.
So you know, you're making the choice for the last questioner, because I'm not going to.
I'm making the choice. Blue hat.
Okay. I just was wondering what advice you had for those of us students that are interested in media and journalism. Because I know, with the state of journalism today, there's a lot of temptation to, work for a watchdog group or do indie media just because you need to do more and you won't be a corporate tool. So I'm just
Well, this is a really difficult question, and in the next few weeks I'll be speaking at a lot of journalism schools, and I am worried for people who are interested in going into journalism because this is such a tough climate. I mean, I joked earlier today, I gave a talk in the sociology department here, it's a great sociology department, and I said, who would have thought that you would advise students to go into sociology over journalism because the job market is better. But we've reached a point where I'm almost more likely to advise a smart undergraduate to get a PhD and go take risks in the academic job market than to go into the media business. But the culture, the study of culture and communication has never been hotter or more popular. Look, don't give up. I'm going to be short, I promise. Don't give up on the corporate media. If people like you say we're going to forego careers in journalism, then the world is really in trouble. But it is important to get experience however you can. And so if you're young and you want to get involved, I'd say use the web. Start doing your own local journalism projects. Write for free or for very little money for local publications. They love free content. Work on writing op-eds. Find an organization like City Paper and do whatever you can to get an internship. Don't give up on it. We need to kind of withstand this tumultuous and difficult period, because the truth is we live in a time of extraordinary change and upheaval. We are living on a melting planet, and the consequences of climate change are only just beginning to surface. My God, it was 70 degrees yesterday. We're seeing these tremendous hurricanes. We are in the midst of a war that has no foreseeable endpoint. It's not even clear what the goals of it are at this point. Our cities are sprawling outward at a pace that seems unsustainable. We have record numbers of migrants coming into our metropolitan communities. This is an exciting and scary and strange and difficult time. We need good journalism. We need good information more than ever. So please don't give up on that challenge. It's time to get to work. So thank you very much.